And I was speaking with the conductor. The TTD was saying to me that in hundreds of years, the Mughals couldn't destroy Indian culture. And in the rule of the British, they also couldn't destroy Indian culture. But we ourselves are doing it in the last 50 years. What the Mughals couldn't do in hundreds of years, and what the British couldn't do in 100 years. And he's so right. It's a fact. It's like chasing the Coca-Cola generation everywhere you look. But yet, I see the bright light of hope here in this, the youth of India, the strong young people of India turning back to your culture and preaching to others. There was a young man, he was a pious young man, on the train. He was reading a book by John Grisham. I don't know if you know who John Grisham is. He's a famous American author. And I thought, what is it he will learn from John Grisham? So I gave him an introduction to Bhagavad Gita, and I spoke with him a little bit. His name was Ravi. He was actually a very sunshiny fellow, and a software engineer, as is often the case, and encouraged him to come here to this temple. And he was on vacation to Bombay, so he seemed like he would. So what I'm seeing is happening to India is exactly what Srila Prabhupada foresaw. Srila Prabhupada was so concerned about the future of India that he came to America to get these white elephants and bring them back so that they, Indians, could say, oh, the white elephants are doing, they're doing our thing. Maybe we should check it out. Maybe we should see what our, there's something there. And that is really what happened. I think a lot of us were born in America for that purpose, actually, so that we never really fit very well in American culture, if there is one. And we were immediately drawn to Srila Prabhupada. Sometimes Srila Prabhupada would talk with Indian people when they would come to him, and he would get tears in his eyes over the future of India. Because he would say that if, he would give the example that if there is a child, there are two children, one child knows better and the other child is ignorant, they don't really know better. Then that child who knows better, say the mother says, don't touch the cookie jar. And one child is very young and foolish, doesn't really understand. And the other child is a little bit wise, maybe 7 years old or something, and has some wisdom. If that child who has the wisdom does the bad thing, then automatically he's going to get more of a punishment because he knew better. And so he often gave this example in relation to India, that India knows better. She knows better. India has the sages, thousands of years of strength, of wisdom, and sages behind her. America is just like a foolish child who has they're practically no culture, and now they're losing the money too, and they don't really know better. It doesn't mean they are not going to suffer, but they won't suffer as much as if the child that knows better. So Prabhupada often gave this example, and when he talked with Indian people, he would talk about the future of India. And he was also very, very keenly interested in Russia. I saw this from the earliest time, that he was very interested in the future of the world. Russia, at the time that I was growing up, because I'm much older than all of you, or most of you, I'm in my early 60s, at the time that I was growing up in America, there was a president of Russia, or whatever they're called, and he used to say, your children, grandchildren will be speaking Russian. meaning we're going to take over your country, and your grandchildren are going to all be speaking Russian. Well, turns out the grandchildren are all speaking Sanskrit and singing mantras and going to Vrindavan every year. But that wasn't expected by Mr. Khrushchev or any of the... That was Lord Chaitanya's grace. But you see, the problem with Russia was, he used to explain, like a race of Rakshasas coming up from the lower planetary system. They want to take over the world and teach that there is no God. And this is the worst kind of, this brings the worst kind of suffering, as we all know, is if you don't believe there is God. So Prabhupada focused greatly on Russia, and I saw that his concern for Russia and his concern for India were intertwined, because Russia could eye India also. India is not so far away from Russia. And of course, the Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, all those stans are just north of India. So Srila Prabhupada was very keen to remove this scourge of atheism in the form of the Russian Empire. And while I was in Vrindavan recently, I spoke with the Russians every day. That's one of the reasons I rushed off to Vrindavan, because speaking with the Russian devotees is very inspiring. They have tremendous bhav. They never got to see Srila Prabhupada. They had to go through great suffering. And they're the men who were the most hungry, so now they're really eating, you know? And in the course of one of the meetings that we had, I was asking some of them how they became a devotee. And it so happened there was a devotee there who was a former KGB agent. And I was very shocked that, oh, Lord Chaitanya's mercy is really great. And he explained that in his story that he was actually a KGB agent, and a small book was confiscated from some devotees. And that book, his supervisor told him, you keep this carefully. This is the most dangerous philosophy in the world. So he became curious. He thought, oh, it's so dangerous. I wonder what it's all about. So he asked some of his colleagues to please translate this for him. And nobody would. They were scared. They were too scared. So he went and got an English dictionary. He didn't know any English, and he was trying to translate it. And he became obsessed with this book. Now, his wife was also a KGB agent, and she was head of Communist Party, because her father was big in the empire of, forget his name, Brezhnev or something like that. Anyway, she was very influential, and so she was... Everyone thought he had lost his mind, because he started staying home trying to figure out the meaning of this book. Just obsessed. He was obsessed with this small book. It was Ishopanishad. And so in the course of time, they sent him to psychiatrists. There were so many problems. The children were, everyone was upset because he's gone mad. And of course, you can't quit the KGB. It doesn't work that way. Once a KGB, always a KGB. They will kill you, you know. So he thought, what will I do? So he got very drunk so that they would think that he's useless to them, that he's just a drunk, he's useless. But still, they tried also, once he said they tried to kill him, they came in the car, and he simply said, oh, okay, what is that? If Krishna wants me to die, it's okay. So then they thought he is really crazy. And they wrote him off because he was really crazy. He's a very nice person. He's actually coming to Vrindavan. His son has gone to Gurukul, grown up there. He's a very nice boy. He's married a French devotee. And the whole family is now devotees, is my point. And the way he finally cracked the code, you might say, right before, you see, he still didn't know what is the meaning of this book. But he had a dream. And in the dream, he saw that cup, Mahavishnu. And in that darshan of Mahavishnu, he became totally changed. And then the next day on a subway, someone gave him a Bhagavad Gita. So they've really, really suffered. But India, on the other hand, has it all. She's got it all from birth. You've got the language, so you can go directly to the scriptures. You've got Vyasadeva still living up in the Himalayas. You've got Bhadarik Ashram. You have everything here, and yet you're chasing the Coca-Cola. And it's very sad. I come back to Bombay and I look at these posters, billboards, and I can't even figure some of them out. It's so strange. It's anyway. Lord Chaitanya has sent all wonderful young people as the reinforcements, and I think that if you preach very much, still, the young people are starting to have an interest. They're interested in their culture because it is in their blood, it is in their sanskars, and it's very important. This is I think you have the most important work to do in all the whole world, is to turn India back to her culture. Because this is what Prabhupada brought us over here for. This is what we had to take birth in America for this also, and to help him in this way. And for you folks who already, you have the Indian birth, you have the sanskars, you have the language, which I still haven't, you know, I can't read so many things. I think that this is the most, you're most fortunate. And you're also Lord Chaitanya's reinforcements. Srila Prabhupada encouraged us that this movement will go on. I have no, there may be some ups and downs, always there are some ups and downs, but it will definitely go on. And it's very encouraging to see this here. Actually, when I was calling from the STB booth in the middle of nowhere, I was in Valsad, which is a little town in Gujarat. The person at the STD booth who was helping me told me, oh yes, I have been to Chaupati Temple. I noticed he had a sikha. He was a young man working for the government, but I noticed that he had sikha, and he was very favorable. So your preaching is reaching the grassroots of the youth, and it's very, very important. Srila Prabhupada is be very, very pleased with this work. This is probably, we are just old now and we can't do too much more. Our work is finishing, but your work is just starting. So do it with great enthusiasm, because you have a whole nation to turn back to the culture. You have a whole nation of India, and you've got a lot of competition with those billboards. You know, you've got a lot of competition with the Maya is being promoted. So, do people take these things seriously? Those billboards? Do they actually believe that stuff? Or is it just advertisement? They actually believe this stuff? The insurance and the millionaire woman and they actually believe it. They're very innocent, so they're very easily taken advantage of. It's a very jaded culture that they're trying to copy, and it's such a ridiculous. The way it's done is almost ridiculous. Do you know what I mean? It's anyway. I guess I should talk something about Srila Prabhupada. One of the things that I tell the Russian devotees, and it applies also to you as well, of course, because the Russian devotees feel very sad that they never got to see Prabhupada. Of course, you've had so much contact with Indian culture, you feel right at home, but they're very being raised with atheism, they're very separated. So I always tell them that your grandfather is very powerful. And if you have a very powerful grandfather, just like when the father is away, he's out of town working, the grandfather is there watching the children in the Hindu household, you know, the grandmother and the grandfather. So I always encourage them to look to Srila Prabhupada. He's quite powerful. He's quite able to help even now. It's not like he's gone. He's watching over this movement, and he's making sure everybody is doing this, learning the lessons they need to learn and doing the service that needs to be done. And so I always encourage them to ask your grandfather for help. If you are in a bewilderment and your Gurudev is out of town, or you don't want to trouble him with the things of your mind because he has enough problems to deal with and so much worldwide management, then go to your grandfather and just talk your heart to him. And I always encourage them like that. And I had some notes. I'm very tired from my train ride yesterday. I had a very hard day. In Vrindavan, so many people come to Vrindavan now, but many people are not knowing the many devotees, especially Russian devotees and foreigner devotees, not Indians so much, not knowing the proper way of behavior in Vrindavan. And Prabhupada was very, he stressed very much that in Vrindavan that we behave very properly. Actually, in the history of the universe, in the history of Vaishnavism, Vrindavan has never been open. The Dham has never been open to foreigners. It's never been open to outsiders, foreigners. To Indian people, yes, but not to foreigners. And so Prabhupada was very cautious. Whenever he came there, he was extremely careful about how we behaved, how we interacted with the Brijbasis and so forth. Now I see this has largely been forgotten, and it is a problem because Vrindavan is a very dangerous place. It's a very wonderful place, but if a person makes any aparad or any sin there, it can spoil one's bhakti. And just like if you have the brick wall, and then you smear the concrete on the wall, it becomes like that kind of sin. It's very hard to break it. And so when I was in Vrindavan this time, I was noticing how many people don't know that, that Prabhupada very, very strictly watched out for us, not letting us go outside to wander in different places and become influenced, and making sure that we were very careful in our dealings with the Brijbasis and respecting them, even though maybe they're doing things we would not think would be good, but not to criticize or judge them. And so many things like this. This is one thing that I spoke to the Russians about quite a few times, because nowadays it's become a fashion that Vrindavan is for social life and shopping. And Prabhupada never encouraged that. In fact, he used to say Vrindavan is for 3 days. Because if the mind, if you make aparat in Vrindavan, then you won't be able to come back. And even devotees, unless you've been picked for some particular job, if you have some service, just like the way Srila Prabhupada picked Dhananjaya, who is running the MVT guest house, he was actually selected by Srila Prabhupada to run that, to work in Vrindavan. And it was all arranged directly, and he's still there after so many, many years. And so many senior disciples like that, Daiva Shakti, who was also in Vrindavan when Prabhupada was there, and Dinabandhu, and there are a few very senior devotees, very few, who have remained in Vrindavan for many, many, many years, because Vrindavan is the ultimate test. It's not an easy thing to do, to live there always. And so these devotees, I was encouraging the Russian devotees to go to them and ask them things, ask their advice on things, because they've seen it all. They've seen so many different tricks of, you know, in Vrindavan, one's mind can become confused, and so many things can happen. It's almost, it's very mysterious. On the other hand, it's also very wonderful. If one's consciousness is pure, it's very wonderful. But mostly it's not meant for, Prabhupada stressed that it was not meant for household life, that it was meant for end of life. It was meant for sannyasis and brahmacharis. Maintaining the temple, of course, he stressed this very much. And now it's become totally different. It's very shocking. And so I was trying to explain that to them. And if you have contact with devotees there, it's good to let them know this, that this is not, it's like playing with fire. You cannot go to Vrindavan and do opera or use Vrindavan for your enjoyment. It will not be, it will destroy your Krishna bhakti. And Prabhupada was very cautious in this way. Sitala was saying that when the day the temple opened, they didn't even know if there was going to be riots in the streets, because it was such an unusual thing to open an Angrezi temple in the Dham. It was such so many people were upset about this. The caste Goswamis, so many people, they were critical of this whole procedure. So the Vrindavan is, because I'm just saying these things because I've seen what happens there. And so many devotees, you see they're doing something and then they're gone and you never see them again. And so it's a very tough test. Actually, for myself, I cannot stay too long in Vrindavan. As long as I have service, I can stay, and then after that, I have to go. And once in Hawaii, before I ever went to India, this is in early 70s, I hadn't even been to India yet. We really didn't have that much contact with India, because in those days, communications weren't as they are today. And Prabhupada was coming off a morning walk in Waimanalo, which is on the beach. He would walk on the beach every day. And he came to the yard, and he was sitting and chanting, and out of the blue, just completely out of the blue, he said, "Govindasi, don't try to retire to Vrindavan so long you are young. So long you are young, you must preach and spread my mission. Only when you are old, then you can go to Vrindavan. If you retire to Vrindavan too young, the mind will agitate. Your job is to preach and spread my mission." So, of course, he knew my nature in advance, that as soon as I got to Vrindavan, I would go, "I'm home. I don't want to go anywhere." But he told me that in advance. So we have to remember that he made it so clear that so long we are young, so long we are able to preach, to spread Lord Chaitanya's mission, that's our job. And then when we are old, before the time of death, we will have the Sukriti. We will have the blessings of the Vaishnavas, of Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan party. Then we can go there and we can chant Hare Krishna peacefully and leave this world, if we're really lucky. Of course, you never know. Is there some particular thing about Srila Prabhupada that anyone would like to ask or like me to speak on? Because I'm so tired today, my mind is not working very well. Does anyone have any particular question?
Thank you for the wonderful class. When we read about Srila Prabhupada, when we read about Srila Prabhupada pastimes, especially when he talks with the reporters or some other people and they ask some question, he always replies differently. Like at a different countries, a reporter may ask the same question, but he would always reply differently as he is feel inspired. So do you have, will you relate some incidents where his response is very spontaneous and...
Okay, I think I heard your question, but just in case I didn't hear it properly, tell me. Well, I think I heard what everything was. Well, my thoughts on that, when I was with Srila Prabhupada, I would always be really anxious to see how he was going to answer, because I knew it was going to always be different. It was because he could see into the person's soul what they needed to hear and the whole culture. He had such vision that he could see what is the whole basis, what the person is thinking. You see, they may be asking one thing, but what are they thinking? He could see. And also what it is they need to hear. I would be amazed sometime because I would think, oh, I know the answer to that. And then he would answer something totally different. And I would just go, wow, that's true too. And that was the perfect thing. No, he always answered exactly perfectly according to the time, place, circumstance, and the personality that he was talking to. Because every situation is actually different. See, we don't have that ability. At least I don't. But every situation is different. And every country is different. The people are at a different level of understanding. And Prabhupada being Jagat Guru, he is Acharya for the whole world. His jurisdiction is stretching over the whole world. He's obviously got to answer the questions of people who are steeped in atheism, like Russia, or people who are steeped in hedonism, like America, or people who have got the whole religious thing from birth, like India. So there's a vast difference in adhikar. Adhikar, the eligibility, spiritual understanding, eligibility to understand knowledge. So I've also noticed this. His lectures in one place will be so different. His lectures in Hawaii, for example, are very different from his lectures in Vrindavan. And the lectures in Vrindavan are very different from the lectures in UK, in London. I've also noticed this. But it's because he's giving what the person can understand. That's my understanding of it. And I was always, because I was with Srila Prabhupada for, I knew him for about 10 years. And off and on, I would see him. And then in the very early days, I was with him continuously for over a year. So I saw many different situations like this where people would come in. And sometimes he would be so hard on somebody. And I would go, whoa. And then another time, someone would come in. He would just be so charming and sweet and soft, you know. And I would just be bewildered that he knows exactly what that person needs. So that's what I'm, if you see some differences, believe me, those differences are well calculated. They're just like arrows hitting exactly the mark perfectly. And even now, sometimes I look back at some things that he said to me that I just, you know, they just went like whoop at the time, you know. They just went over my head or right through one ear and out the other, just, but I didn't understand them. But in the course of time, I came to understand them. I can give you one example of this. When I was only 28 years old, I was very young still, and my husband had left. So naturally, I was very upset. I was weeping. I was very, we were hoping that he would come back, and he had left due to political complications. And so I went to see Srila Prabhupada. He was up high in this, it's called the Ilika. It's a very nice condominium hotel type place in Hawaii. And I went there to see him, and he could see I was very crying, very upset. This was the first time I had seen him since this unfortunate thing had happened. And so he sent his servants away so that I was sitting on the floor, sitting alone there with him. And he said, "So what happened?" And so I told him. And I was kind of expecting a little bit of consolation, you know, like, "Oh, my poor daughter, my poor child." That's what I was kind of expecting. Well, I didn't get it. Instead, he looked out over the ocean. The ocean was down below, many stories down. So from a distance, you could see waves are coming, you know. If you're looking at the ocean from in a building up high. And he said, "This material relationships of husband and wife and children, family, they're just like bubbles in the ocean. They're coming together for a few moments, they're clinging together, and then again another wave is coming and they're dispersed. So you are very fortunate. You have no husband, you have no children, you have only Krishna. You are very fortunate." Now, that was the last thing in the world I needed to hear at the time, I thought. I was like, but you know what? Now, 30 years later, I am so grateful that he gave me that instruction. And yet, in other cases, I've seen that it hasn't been like that. Depending on the person, what they needed. And so I needed to learn detachment. And so that was the instruction that he gave me, was to learn this detachment. And I had to learn it the hard way. It was a very difficult lesson for me. I was extremely attached and extremely thinking that this was a part of my identity. You see? But actually, he had to point out to me. And when Prabhupada would point something out to you, it would penetrate all the layers of your consciousness, just like an arrow coming in. And so why, after more than 30 years, I'm 3062, so that was 28, so more than 30 years still, I'm remembering that day exactly and the power of that instruction that he gave me. And so it was like that. With different people, he would give the different instruction according to the problem that they had to work on or the need that they had. Does that answer your question?
Hare Krishna Mataji, we read one pastime, Prabhupada himself was narrating about you, like about the time when you wanted to massage Prabhupada and Prabhupada refused and you started crying and Prabhupada was like enjoying. He was saying that, you know, how much he wanted to serve, you know. Like Prabhupada was narrating this pastime later after many years to some sannyasis, just like that. And this, he was saying, like, "I remember in the early days when Gaurasundara Prabhu was massaging me, one day Govindadasi, she came into my room and she was also insisting, 'No, I want to massage Prabhupada, please let me massage Prabhupada.' And Prabhupada was laughing. I was like, you know, he's laughing and he's telling the sannyasis that, you know, I'm a sannyasi, so I could not allow a woman to touch me. So I said no, but Govindadasi, she wanted to serve me so much, so badly, she was crying. So, can you narrate something about this?
Well, I was like a child, and we didn't know in America what was a sannyasi, you know. We only, at that time, you have to also understand, you're coming to a very full-blown ISKCON. At the time when we had Prabhupada, we only knew he was like our father or our grandfather. I was 22, so he was 70s, like grandfather. Just like if you had a grandfather and your grandfather was ill, you would want to rub his feet, massage his feet, so he would feel better. So the mood was really like that. It was very, and it was very sincere on our part, my part, Jadrani part. However, Prabhupada was very strict because he wanted to teach us. There were no sannyasis at that time. We didn't know what was really the meaning of sannyasi yet. But later, see, Prabhupada is telling his sannyasis, so they will see that, oh, Prabhupada is very strict. He would not allow this sort of thing. So that no sannyasis will think, oh, Prabhupada let, so I will also do. That can happen, you know. But actually, Prabhupada was very, very paka, strict sannyasi, even though he was just like our grandfather. He would not allow us to rub his feet or touch his feet, even giving blessing. I remember once from a distance he patted Jadrani on the head, and I was very jealous because he never patted me on the head once, you know, not once. But that and yet he would. You know, he was, it wasn't like, I mean, he was in his 70s, he was very old, right? So it wasn't like that, but he's doing for example, to teach others. This is the thing. But we didn't know at that time, we just think he's like grandma. See, we didn't have the same background. You folks know from your childhood, what is a sannyasi, what is this, what is that? We don't know any of these things, nothing. We just simply, actually, we only knew Prabhupada's wonderful smile and the energy of divine love that around him. We were like a small family. You know, in the evening, in the very beginning in New York, when we were there, we would sit in a semicircle in his room. His room was so tiny. Oh my gosh, half the size of the deity room. Very small, square room. And so you can see not so many people could fit. But maybe there was maybe 10 of us, and we would sit in a semicircle, and he would sit on his mat on the floor where he worked, and he also slept there. And we would just visit and talk just like we were a family in the evening. And we didn't know anything. Actually, if you think what a miracle it is that he did so much with just a handful of ignorant teenagers who didn't know anything of Indian culture, anything of, and even how to wash our hands after eating. We didn't know any of these things. And yet he was able to teach us. So that is the best explanation I can give you on that. Is that okay? Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna Mataji. I've read that you were the first one to call Prabhupada as Prabhupada in Boston. So can you brief about that incident, that conversation that you had?
That's actually a very important point. Very important point. That we called Prabhupada Swamiji up until in May of 1968. Yeah. And in May of 1968, we were in Boston for 1 month. He was speaking at different colleges there. He was speaking at MIT. He was speaking at all the important, famous colleges there. And my husband at the time was studying Sanskrit and Bengali. And so because he was learning these suffixes and prefixes, he learned this word G. You know how people would go, oh, Mukunda G, oh, like that, as a term, affectionate term. So he, one day I was sitting in the room taking dictation, and Srila Prabhupada was giving letters, dictation. He has his desk, which is a trunk. Srila Prabhupada's desk was a trunk, an Indian trunk. That's how he lived. Everything went into the trunk when we moved, and then whenever we got to where we were going, everything came out of, not everything, but most things came out of the trunk, his Bhagavatam, his Chaitanya Charitamrita, whatever was there. And that became, he had a little cushion on the floor, and his trunk was his desk. And this is how he lived, very simply, very, very simply. Even when he had so much, he lived the same way. So anyway, this one day, Gorsundar came to the, my former husband came to the door and said, Swamiji, is it okay? I'm learning this G suffix, and it's an affectionate term I've read. Is it okay if I call Govinda Dasi Govinda G? And so Prabhupada said, Swamiji said, it is not a very first-class form of address. It is a third-class form of address. So you have to understand, we don't know anything. You know, you just imagine if you have a bunch of kittens or something. They don't know anything of the culture. What this means, what that means, nothing. So then I thought, well, if it's a third-class form of address, how come we're calling you this? Because we wouldn't like to call you something nicer. And he said, oh, it's not very important. You know, this is not very important. And so I said, but I think it's very important. And so he said, no, it doesn't matter, because we were calling him Swami Ji. And so I said, is there some better thing that we can call you? Because if this is a third-class form of address, we would like to have more first-class form. And he said then, well, after my pressing him, immediately he didn't agree. But he was pressured. I was saying, no, please, give us something, please. And then he said, all right, you can call me Gurudev or Guru Maharaj or Prabhupada. So I said, well, that's three. Which one? You know, like, which of the three would you like the best? If you give us one, is better. And so then he said, all right, you can call me Srila Prabhupada. And then from that day, I told him, okay, from today, you will be called Srila Prabhupada. And then I told the devotees, there weren't so many devotees then, we all started calling him Srila Prabhupada. This has caused some problem, I've heard, with some of his godbrothers. I've heard this. But you know what? I actually think that one of the reasons for this is because it made him think of his Srila Prabhupada. That's what I'm actually thinking. But that's my speculation. Don't write that down. But that's just my speculation. But in any case, from that time on, he became known as Srila Prabhupada. And now he's known all over the world as Srila Prabhupada. And it's much better because Swamiji is, now that I know a little more about Indian culture, I see Swamiji is used in so many ways that are not at all appropriate for such a great acharya. So I think that was Krishna's arrangement. Definitely Krishna's arrangement that he should be called that. It was just that we are given the part to play, just like in a drama. We all have our roles, just like we're in a theater. We have given different roles to play, and so Krishna somehow gave that role. That, oh, now we need to change his name properly because he's going to be so famous. Is there anything else? Dr. Dwarkadish, do you have any question?
Prabhupada had told you to preach in Hawaii. So, can you remember any instructions he gave for you to carry on your preaching in Hawaii at that time?
Many instructions were there. Where do I begin? When he sent us to Hawaii, he told us to preach to the people there. And once when we visited him in Los Angeles, and we were leaving to go back, he had tears coming down his cheeks. He said, "The people of this world are suffering, although they do not know it. They're suffering due to lack of Krishna consciousness. So you please go and teach them about Krishna." And it was as if the embodiment of compassion was there. Preaching with compassion. This is an important point, actually, that you brought up. Because sometimes I've seen that people will preach with a mood of, "I'm better than you. You know, I know and you don't." But he didn't even preach like that. Srila Prabhupada preached with a mood of compassion. It was like he genuinely felt compassion for those souls who are not knowing about Krishna. They're thinking they're having a good time. They're thinking they're happy. But actually, they're just headed for the gate of death, that's all. And so he preached, he taught us to preach with compassion. I think when we were younger, we weren't able to realize that as much. But now I think as we become older, we can see that. Rather than feeling that, oh, we're so better than you, or we are so different than you, now I look at the situations and I feel that Prabhupada was so... He's seeing things truly. Just like you see some very big man, very rich, very successful, but where are they now? In the nursing home, drooling? See? Like that. They're actually such a small part of life is available for use in developing Krishna bhakti. And the rest is just in ignorance and childhood play. And the other part is old man suffering so many bodily miseries, so many miseries of the mind. Oh, my son did this, my daughter did this, I had this problem, that problem. Whole mind is just whirlwind of anxiety and anguish. This is the old age. And only in between, there's this very short period. And as we get older, we see this. And so we can see that when we preach, it has to be with compassion, not thinking, "I'm so much smarter than you because I know something you don't know." I could just be as well as be them, you know? And in any moment, any one of us can be gone, you know, just like that. In a second, we don't know. So I think that that's what probably one of the most significant moods of preaching that I saw. He told us to do Panchatattva. He told us how to worship Panchatattva. He did. He came many times to Hawaii, many times. And he taught us so many things. But if I had to pick out one thing that stands above all the others, I think it's the preaching with compassion, with genuine concern for each soul, each jiva, as opposed to just, as we've seen sometimes, and as we've also done sometimes in our immature stages, just preaching because we sound good. You know what I mean. Does that answer your question?
Which one? Where did this?
This Prabhu is asking, can you please share the dream that you had of Srila Prabhupada, which you had narrated at Srila Prabhupada's disappearance festival in Vrindavan 2005. I can't even remember what I did yesterday, what to speak of 2005. So I need to know, and so many dreams I've had of Srila Prabhupada. So if you can just please tell me which one, then I can know.
You had narrated that Prabhupada Samadhi, you saw Prabhupada there, and Prabhupada was still, you know, you said that Prabhupada is still living and, you know, monitoring all of us.
Okay, I understand which dream it was. I wasn't sure because there was another very significant dream that I had of Srila Prabhupada, which had a painting painted of, and which I have now, that painting is with me. I had Satchidananda, the Russian artist, do it because he's a lot better artist than I am. And so I thought that was the one you meant. But this dream was different. I was working for my father in Texas. My father had a big business at the time, which he was losing. He lost in the court case. And I was trying to help him in the court case. So it was a very difficult time for me. And I was feeling what to do. And so one morning, early morning, I also had ear infection, so I didn't go to Mangalartik, and my friends had gone. I was staying with some devotees near the Houston temple. It was 1995, and 95. And so in the dream, all I heard was Prabhupada's voice. He said, Govindasi. I was driving round and round in a parking garage. You know, big place, you know. And I was driving my car round and round and round in circles. And he didn't say anything except that I heard him call my name, Govindasi. He never said Govindadasi. He said Govindasi. And so I heard his voice, and the import of it was, come on out of there. So I drove my car out of the parking garage in the dream. This is all in a dream. And the next thing I knew, I was in some type of airplane landing above Mayapur. But I didn't see the airplane. I was just up high. And so in the distance, I saw in the field, Srila Prabhupada was coming, walking in the field with four or five dignitaries, whatever that means. That's just what it was in my dream. Four or five dignitaries. Could be Panchatattva. And anyway, he was coming toward this gateway. And there were tall fences that were like partitions. In other words, open sky, but a very tall fences. Separating everything in the dream. But I had never seen this type of fence, so I didn't, it wasn't quite bamboo, but it was like bamboo. But I had not seen it ever in my life, so I couldn't quite tell what it was. It was unfamiliar to me. And then there was a gateway where, and like an anteroom, and Prabhupada was coming, he was coming out into this anteroom, and many old Prabhupada disciples were there waiting. They were anxiously waiting. I remember Malati was there, and so So many old Prabhupada disciples were waiting. And the import of the dream was that I'm coming back into the center of the society. This is my debut. I'm coming back into the center. And this was before the 1996 centennial. So I woke up. Tears, naturally. When you dream of your spiritual master, naturally you're going to wake up crying. You know, you're going to feel that you feel the incredible separation because you've been so close, and then suddenly you wake up and here you are again. And so I was crying and everything, and I talked to my friend, my girlfriend Kusha. I told her about the dream. And anyway, very soon after that, I did drive out of the parking garage. I left the job there in Texas and gave up and went back home to Hawaii. And about a year later, I got a phone call from my friend, Kusha, saying, you need to go to India. You don't have the... Well, my father had lost all his fortune in the court case. He was 78 years old. He lost over $10 million. He lost everything he had in the court case. So it was kind of depressing. And so she said, you don't have money now, but I'm paying your ticket because you took me before. So I said, okay. And I went to India. And it was before the 1996 celebration. But it was in 1996. And so I went to Mayapur, and this is before the big festival. And I was sitting and chanting in the Bhajan Kutir of Prabhupada. He had a Bhajan Kutir there. And it's a mud hut, cow dung and mud hut, which was his favorite. He actually liked that better than palaces. He always liked those cow dung mud huts with the little thatched roofs. I think he felt more like it's a village. You know, so I was sitting and chanting japa there, and just chanting one morning, and suddenly I felt Prabhupada's presence. His presence there, so much overwhelming, just like he's sitting there, and I began to cry. And then he's speaking to me within my mind. He said, so, I wanted you to be here for my debut, my coming back into the center of my ISKCON society. You've cried for so many years. You cried so long. You had cried about the situation, so I wanted you to be here. And then I remembered the dream. Because in the dream, there were those tall, thatched bamboo things. But when I came there, I saw there like a thatch, something I had not ever seen before. It's a Bengali thatched, it's not bamboo, but it's made of some kind of leaves. And certainly there were these tall, exactly as I had seen in the dream, these structures, which were like an open, open to the top, but really tall walls. And it was this that I had seen in the dream. And so then in that course of time, while Srila Prabhupada was, I was feeling his presence so much there in this darshan, I asked some questions about the situation in the society. And I got answers that were very satisfying to my mind, which was troubled at that time because so many problems had arisen in ISKCON society. And one of the things which he said to me was, I'm only capitalizing on a few things I remember. I don't remember everything, but I wrote everything down in detail, which I can give this person if they want it. But one of the things which I ask about was the situation. And Prabhupada's answer to me was, many people have done great austerities in this movement. They have performed great austerities. And if they have some desire for something, then they can attain this, say for some power, or some wealth, or some prestige, or anything. Then they can get this. But if they misuse it, they will be corrected just as though they will be certainly corrected just as surely as those who have gone before. And then the main important thing that he said to me was that don't think that I'm not watching over this society. I'm guiding everything. I'm watching over everything. Don't think that I have left you. Don't ever think that I've left you. This is my ISKCON society. I'm very much concerned for the future direction, and I'm guiding it all. And so this was a very great reassurance to me, having seen a lot of the things that I saw from the time that Srila Prabhupada left. And so this dream was this was not a dream. This part was very much real. It was, of course, dreams of Guru are also real, but this was more of a darshan. And so the main thing he gave me, encouragement, that definitely I am watching over this society. And he is. And actually, in the West, people are a little thick-headed in this regard because we don't have the culture that you have. And your culture, it is commonly understood that great saints are not confined to their physical form. Great saints do many things while they are present and after they are physically present before the eyes. And this is something that you commonly understand. But people in the West have little thick heads on this one. They can't quite get that. They think somebody's dead, they're dead. It's not like that. It's not like that. That may be true for the ordinary being. Not dead, but gone someplace you don't know where they've gone. But not for the Acharya. And this is a big problem. This has been the big problem, and it continues to be the big problem, that we don't understand this in the West. But in India, you have the vision to understand this, that Srila Prabhupada is not gone. The great saints, great acharyas, they are present in ways that we cannot understand. And so this is something that is very easy for you to digest, but very difficult for the Western mind to digest. I wish I had better understanding of it. I do. But maybe Christianity has that concept to some extent, but most people don't understand this in America. Some devotees understand. Anyway, it's a kind of an esoteric thing. No, I was not at the opening of Krishna Balaram Temple. I was not there. I was in Hawaii. I think I was not well at the time. I wish I had been there. I very much wish that I had been there. Srila Prabhupada asked me if I was going to come, but I was not in good health at the time. That was just after my husband had left, and I was not in good physical health or mental health at the time. But so, no, they're asking if I was there. But Sitala spoke about this, and she's living in Mayapur. Sitala is Harisori's wife. She had some very good things to say about this opening ceremony. It was very nice. I think you must be getting hungry. It's 9:25. Is there any other questions? When is Ekadasi? Huh?
Tomorrow.
I was feeling like it must be soon. Naturally, I'm flying on Ekadasi. When I came, I flew on Ekadasi. It was so difficult. And now I have to fly on Ekadasi again. Because you don't know, day and night, there's no day and you cross the date line. So, you know.
Hare Krishna, Mataji. I have a friend from the Western countries as well, the UK, and he found it very difficult to accept deities. And he saw Ganesh and Mother Durga, and he immediately asked, how could someone have like 10 limbs or head of an elephant? And it was so difficult for me to talk to this person about Krishna. So I want to know whether you recall any instances where Srila Prabhupada may have discussed this matter to the American devotees.
You mean the person does not accept that Krishna is God, or the person...
The person doesn't accept Hinduism because of all these pictures of demigods he's seen and the idols he's seen.
He prefers impersonalism.
He's agnostic. He's really confused. Confused agnostic. He's not certain of anything. But he doesn't acknowledge Hinduism at all because of what he's seen about the demigods and all their forms, pictures that he has seen.
What can you do? If he has no natural attraction, what can you do? We can't preach to someone who's totally averse. There's a very funny story in Burijan's book about Srila Prabhupada. When he's speaking, I think it's in Singapore or is it in Hong Kong, where he is one of the swamis on the evening agenda. You know, meaning he's going to speak, and there's some Maivad sannyasis too. And so after he speaks, then when Maivad sannyasi begins to speak, you know this story? It was so perfect. And this Maivad sannyasi began to talk about impersonal Krishna, not having, of course it was done in Hindi and the devotees didn't know what's going on because it's being done in Hindi and it's for the Indian congregation. And so suddenly Srila Prabhupada said, start kirtan, in the middle of this guy's talk, start kirtan, immediately start kirtan. And so the devotees just did what they were told. They just started clanging cymbals and drowning him out and had a big kirtan. Of course, it upset a lot of people. It upset the Indian group who they were hoping to support the temple that they were going to build. And I mean, I don't know all the details. I wasn't there. And it upset the Maivad sannyasi who was speaking, who suddenly got drowned out by kirtan. But afterwards, the devotees were just flabbergasted. They just did what they were told, so that was good. But afterwards, Prabhupada said to them, I could tolerate it when they talk about the, worship of Ganesh, I forget the word. Huh? Panchopasana. That I could tolerate. But when he began to talk that Krishna has no form, I could not bear the sound of this. Prabhupada was very apologetic, you know, because he had just screwed up the whole rapport of the Indian community by doing this. But he was like, I'm sorry, I could not tolerate this. It was too much painful for me. So I thought this was a nice story because it's like he has genuine love for Krishna. It's just like if you love your grandfather or your mother and somebody starts saying how she has no eyes, she has no legs, she has no ears, it hurts your heart. And this is this is what he was feeling, that it's too much painful for me. And so your friend has a mood like this, and so it must be painful for you to deal with. On the other hand, what can you do sometimes? The world has been poisoned by impersonalism. When I was with Srila Prabhupada, I didn't have a clue what impersonalism was. I still don't completely understand it. It doesn't make sense to me at all. But I remember him talking about it all the time, so I thought it must be important. And one day I asked him something and he said, oh, the whole world has become impersonalist in this day and age. And I thought, really? Well, I don't know what it is exactly. I couldn't figure out what impersonalism was. But now, so many years later, having dealt with so many people, especially in India, but now it's invaded the West too, this attitude of God has no form is just like a disease that has spread everywhere. And it's a very difficult. Once you get poisoned by this, it's like taking poison through the ear. It will take some special grace to rescue you. But actually, that's the case. I saw this practically some years ago. I saw one lady friend. She actually wanted to become a devotee. She even had little Radha Krishna deities. But she had been so steeped, and she was a Muktananda disciple. Muktananda, you know Muktananda? Yogi, famous yogi, probably. But she couldn't really grasp it. And so I think, we think that becoming a devotee is something we do, but it isn't. Becoming a devotee is grace of the God in the heart. Nobody becomes Vaishnava on their own effort. All is grace. The grace of the Vaishnava, like Srila Prabhupada, the grace of the Vaishnavas who were worshipping Krishna, the grace of Krishna, actually. So, I don't know what to say for your friend. You can just give him prasadam. Again and again and again, if you give him prasadam, that was Prabhupada's way. These fools and rascals, give them prasadam. It worked for us. I mean, America's the most fool and rascal country in the world, practically. So sometimes you cannot preach on that. That's why you see in Prabhupada's lectures in India, they're so much more intricate, so much more detailed, so much more philosophically based. And you see his lectures in the West and you compare the two. Have you done this? You'll see. He realized that the people have cow dung, or worse, maybe, not cow dung, maybe buffalo. So they can't understand certain things. You know, they're not able to understand. So therefore, he made big festivals and give prasadam. Big festivals and prasadam. And philosophical things, he didn't encourage so much. But they think they're big philosophers. That's the problem. Any other question? Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to serve you in some way. You're very, very wonderful devotees. Now we're on our way out. We're old and we won't be here much longer. And so you beautiful shining faces of Lord Chaitanya's army, the job is yours now to spread this all over India. And I'm sure that you'll do a better job than we've done. Hare Krishna.